Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The naked body of Sheila Shepherd was found in her Saratoga apartment this morning by her uncle. She was found lying on her bed with stab wounds. Her family had been notified when her teacher had become worried. The 22-year-old woman was enrolled in a work-study program at the Worldwide Educational Center just down the street from her apartment. She missed class yesterday. Her teacher thought she just might be out of town. Today, the teacher became worried.
Because usually our enrollees will call in and tell us why they aren't here for the day to work. So that's why we tried to find out her whereabouts this morning.
The teacher described Sheila as a beautiful girl who was well-liked. She had been married and reportedly has a young child, but she lived alone. Police spent hours on the scene collecting evidence. After the body was taken away, police brought out several bags of evidence, but they had little to say.
Do you have any reason to believe that this was someone who knew her, though, or this could be a random kind of crime?
We have no reason to believe that statement whatsoever, whether it was a random situation or someone knew her or what. We don't know at this point.
So far, police have very little to go on. One clue, a next-door neighbor's daughter says she heard screaming about 10:15 last night. But Sheila's teacher says that when they checked on her yesterday morning, the door was locked and a radio was playing. The door was still locked and the radio was still playing this morning when Sheila was found. Mike Moran, 13 News, Saratoga.
Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance in the Crawl Space studios in Wormtown. Lance, how are you today?
Doing really well. How are you doing today, Tim?
I'm doing well. And today, Lance, for this episode, we have the beginning of some casework that we're doing again. Feels good.
Yeah, it feels good to be back in Wormtown in the Crawl Space studios, as I like to say, nestled here in the Crawl Space studios. But last week, we were up in Saratoga Springs, New York, and we were walking around with two very fine police detectives and talking about a coming up on 40-year-old unsolved murder. And you're right, it felt good to take charge of that.
Yeah, beautiful town, Saratoga Springs, and we met with investigators Chris Callahan and Matt Wilson of the Saratoga Springs Police Department. They were nice enough to allow us to spend a couple of days with them, really, or maybe a day and a half. And so we met these fine gentlemen in Albany, New York, earlier this year, Lance, in April of 2019. They saw our panel with that snappy jacket wearing John Lorden and with the true crime guy, Mike Morford, the one that we did at the American Investigative Society of Cold Cases.
It's really crazy how these things come together. So that was back in April, and we do this panel, which is pretty much I guess kind of a broad stroke of how you maintain a true crime podcast and just how you go about your daily day-to-day business with it. And They heard that and they thought to themselves that this might be something to incorporate in this particular murder that they're looking into. And the next thing that falls into place for this is their superiors say, you have pretty much carte blanche to do whatever you want with this if it's going to shake something loose. And being a part of it is really, really special.
Yeah, they must have liked something that that we set up there. You know, we were also talking about how we work with law enforcement and with families and try to shake loose tips and things like that. And that right. is what they're looking for. So if you know any information in the murder of Sheila Shepherd, this is an unsolved murder from Saratoga Springs, New York in 1980. So if you know anything, if you have any information, please call the tip line. The number is 518-584-8477. That's 518-584-8477. And that number is in the show notes as well as Investigator Callahan's direct line.
We can probably say that this is the first episode that we're going to do on Sheila Shepherd. There's going to be a series of episodes. It's the only unsolved murder in Saratoga Springs history. It was also profiled by the great John Douglas, who was essentially the founder of the behavioral science unit of the FBI. So there's a profile written on this case and who might have committed this crime. But just from a layman point of view, not being a detective, you look at this and it's bizarre right off the bat for so many reasons. And you'll hear this unfold during this interview.
Yeah, it's a very fascinating case, and what we find out through the course of this conversation that we have with investigators Callahan and Wilson, we find out that the killer spent some time with the body after he or she killed Sheila.
Now, Sheila was murdered right before Thanksgiving. They found her body on November 25th. They estimated her to be murdered probably 2 days before that, over the weekend. She was 22 years old. And she had just moved back into the area. She'd been there for a few months. She had a young daughter, and she was estranged from her husband. When you look at a murder that has a clear rage element to it, multiple stab wounds or bruising, you can put together a much more solid scenario as to what happened. And what really is a brain scratcher on this one, to give a John Lorden shout out here, is that there's no bruising, there's no signs of struggle. She's tied to a bed, but there's no multiple bruising marks or tie marks on her wrists or her feet. Like, where she was tied was where her limbs stayed. All of this seems to be post-mortem.
That's right, Lance. So the killer spent some time with Sheila after he or she killed her. And he or she also stabbed Sheila in the abdomen once, as we go over in the interview with the investigators. But what we found out from our new friend at the University of New Hampshire, she's a forensic anthropology professor. Her name's Amy Michael. We found out that the killer spent no less than a half an hour with Sheila after killing her because the puncture wound of the knife, There was no blood.
We were told that. We were told that there was one single drop of blood, but when we saw the picture of the knife in the body, I didn't see any drop of blood. It must have been incredibly minute, but it was only from the initial puncture wound into her stomach. And what we found out from Amy at the University of New Hampshire, because what occurred to us was, how long would somebody have to stay with the body in order for the blood to stop flowing to the point where it's not coming out from a stab wound? And what we found out from Amy at UNH was, based on the lack of blood flow from the wound and the discoloration on Sheila's body, that knife would have had to have gone into her, like you said, no sooner than a half hour after the death. And we're not even sure how she exactly died, as you'll find out in this interview. She had a piece of fabric stuffed in her mouth, but that doesn't really cause the level of asphyxiation that they're talking about. There was no vomit in the throat. There was essentially no sign of her trying to, like, get this thing out of her mouth. So that could have been post-mortem as well. And I mentioned the discoloration on her body from the blood. That suggests a certain period of time that she was laying there, which is how they determined that she was probably murdered Saturday into Sunday, and she was discovered on Tuesday. So it was a couple of days worth of this lividity of blood.
Yeah, and so you can see why this is a really interesting case. It's still unsolved. There was a profile done by John Douglas, which we got a little bit of info from. All right, so I think you'll really enjoy this series. And don't forget to check out the American Crime Fest, Lance, Wildwood, New Jersey, November 8th, 9th, and 10th, 2019. Check out AmericanCrimeFest.com. The schedule has been posted.
And you can buy your tickets there. You can use promo code MMM, and you'll get 10% off your weekend pass, which is just chock full of the who's who of the true crime community. Everyone from Aphrodite Jones to Sarah Turney to Stephen Lampley. We got Maggie Freeling up there. And speaking of John Lorden, it wouldn't be a true crime fest without John Lorden and Mike Morford and all their snappy jackets. So you're not going to want to miss that. You're also not going to want to miss hanging out with me on the boardwalk on Sunday morning, sipping coffee and watching the sunrise.
Oh, you really wish.
I'm going to be drinking my Criminal Perspective commemorative coffee, the Black Widow edition.
Well, that would be nice, Lance, and I would love to join you. So please check out AmericanCrimeFest.com and hope you enjoy this episode of Crawl Space, and you will be hearing more from the Sheila Shepherd case, investigators Chris Callahan and Matt Wilson.
And might I say, Tim, you'll be hearing more and you'll be seeing more because we took a crew up with us. We took a film crew up with us, and we interviewed not only Matt and Chris, we also interviewed the original detective from the case, and we interviewed Sheila's aunt, whose husband at the time was the one who actually found Sheila's body. So, guys, just when you thought we weren't going to dig deep.
Thanks, guys, for coming back and talking about this case with
us.
Really appreciate it.
So you brought in some of these pictures, and we'll just start at the beginning. Sheila Shepherd was 22 years old, and she was murdered on November 25th of 1980. Can you take us back to the scene of the crime?
What was thought from the time of death, coroner's report, police investigation, they think she was actually killed. November 25th was a Tuesday morning. That's when she's found, when the police investigation begins. What was determined was that she was actually killed sometime late Saturday night, early Sunday morning, which have been the 22nd into the 23rd. The timeline's a little hazy on when she's last confirmed seen alive, but it's going to be some point on that Saturday. And then there's different sightings, different people are interviewed that were out in our downtown area in Saratoga on that Saturday night that say they saw her at certain bars, but then a lot of them are kind of hazy. Like, well, I can't be sure if it was actually Saturday into Sunday, may have been Friday into Saturday, but she's definitely found for sure on Tuesday morning, early morning. Again, she's enrolled in a secretarial school at the time, was called Worldwide Enterprises, right down the block from her apartment. The teacher had sent a couple of students over to look for her. She didn't report for class 2 days in a row, and once they couldn't get into the apartment, got no response, knocking on the doors, when they go back, teacher calls Sheila's mother, who comes to the house with her aunt and uncle, and the uncle's one who comes through. The picture on the left there is that's the fire escape that he comes in through, that you could see from when we were at the apartment yesterday. He came up that fire escape because the front door was locked, stepped through the window, and actually has to step right over
her.
Yes. Yeah. And she was, according to him, she was found. She was covered with a blanket or sheet at that time, but like the feet were sticking out. He calls out to her. There's no response. So he says it's obviously there's something wrong there going on. He pulls back the sheet and sees that, you know, she does appear to be deceased. Then goes and calls the police, and our investigation begins from there.
I can imagine that he saw her through the window.
He said he could see her through the window, but again, that she's covered.
Yeah.
So he knows she's in the bed there, but just that she's not responding to his calling out her name.
And he can't see anything other than part of her head. Was her head fully covered, or was it?
I think it says the head was fully covered. There was a leg protruding out of the side of the sheet.
Okay.
I think he sees on this bottom right here something like that. You know, you saw that. Yeah, that there's someone in the bed.
And she, her feet are tied with her shoe, her own shoelaces?
Correct.
Yes, and then this is like a, what do you call it?
Terry
like
cloth.
A belt, yeah, from a terry cloth robe.
That's oh, okay, that's...
Tying her hands.
Yeah.
And I can't remember what the fourth tie is now.
I believe it's going to be something similar to the... There's two shoelaces and I think two kind of sashes like that, tying the hands.
And that was Sheila's robe?
We believe so, yeah.
And she's tied spread-eagled, so she's got all, you know, two hands, 2 feet that are, you know, all directions tied to the bed frame. But it, even just looking closely at it, it doesn't really appear that, you know, she's tied down before death, because the shoelaces are flimsy. They're not any sort of intricate knots. They said they were kind of like just a double overhand, you know, like you tie your shoe with, and. Mm-hmm. There's no abrasion marks on her. It doesn't look like anything. She's struggling against the ties. So the theory was, and it definitely, I agree, that makes sense that she's tied up after she's already dead.
And what else happened after she died?
She had a, what was it, a blouse?
It's a belt that went to like a coat. Like a cloth belt that went to a woman's coat, or maybe a sweater or something. Like a,
yeah, I'll take a
throw. We actually spoke to the owner of that. She said she had let her borrow it. But it was like a cloth sash that was tied over her mouth, stuffed down into her mouth, and then the steak knife was piercing her abdomen.
So it was a steak knife.
Correct.
So all that was after she was dead.
The one single stab wound, there's no blood coming from the area. I think there might be a drop where it pierces the flesh, but it's not like, you know, if you stab somebody and they're alive and they're actively still, you know, still spurting blood. So it looks like it's probably even, I wouldn't say quite a while, but it's, you know, time has passed that she's been dead before somebody sticks this knife into her abdomen, which obviously is the part that doesn't really make sense.
Yeah. Was it from her apartment?
It matches the set that she has in her kitchen drawer. There's actually original detectives had pictures in there of all the cutlery, and had seized all this other cutlery that we, you know, still have now that matches her set. So it looks like somebody just
went through her set.
Yeah, I don't know if it's
if it was sitting spontaneous on the table, or.
So what is the cause of death?
Asphyxiation.
So. Like someone suffocated her or strangled her, or
no, wouldn't have been strangled. Would have been, you know, suffocated, or that the
belt or whatever.
Yeah, if that's down, if that's, you know, restricting her airway. The only thing that with that is there's no there's not a lot of vomit on her or from or on that object, which you would think if that is the actual item that caused the death, that would have caused some sort of gag. You know, reflex and vomit, but could have been a pillow placed over her head. You know, we obviously can't say for sure on that.
What was her life like? Who was she?
Well, she was pretty much born and raised in Saratoga Springs. Her father had her when he was in the military, stationed down in Florida. Has Sheila down there. She was born in 1958. They move back to Saratoga Springs, and she's very young. Grows up there. She ends up meeting a guy who's also in the military that she gets married to. They go away. Well, he's stationed different places. They're stationed in Germany. He's then stationed in California.
She lived in Germany?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
Then in California with him. They have a young daughter, as you can see in some of the pictures. She was three at the time that Sheila was murdered. Sheila had left her husband in California. They had split up, and she went to live in Colorado for a time, which is the ones you can see with the mountains in the background there. That it is her Aunt Terry that you're going to meet later on today. That's actually the... wife of the uncle who discovers Sheila in the apartment.
Terry.
Okay. Terry Armstrong was married to Charles Bousseau at the time, who's the one that goes through the window and finds her. But Sheila left California, where her husband was stationed, took the baby to to Colorado and stayed with Terry and Charles for a time there.
So that's where Terry was living in Colorado? That's why they went there? Mm-hmm. And then she made her way back to Saratoga Springs after that?
Yes. Her husband actually comes and takes the baby with her permission, takes their daughter, Sativa, comes back to Saratoga, where his parents are living in the time or just outside of, and then Sheila, a little while later, makes her way back to Saratoga, I want to say in August of 1980.
Yeah, end of August or August.
So the kid was living in Saratoga as well, in the same town as Sheila, but just not in the same residence.
Well, just outside. It's, okay. It's called Greenfield. It's just like the kind of rural surrounding area of Saratoga. His parents ran an RV park there that the daughter was with Richard Shepherd's parents.
We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsor.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it, and we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program.
And how long after they split up, Sheila and Richard, was she killed?
6 months-ish. I didn't check her timeline here. All right, so she moves. All right, May of 1980 is when she moves back to Saratoga for good, and in 1978 is when her and Richard had split up.
Oh, okay.
And that's when a couple of years, 2 years, and
but they maintained connection, contact.
Yeah, yeah. Them. They had been in contact. It sounds like, and from everyone that we've talked to, there was no custody dispute. There was no fighting over who should have the baby. It seemed like they both kind of agreed that the baby was better off with his parents. That neither one were in a really good place to raise a child at the time.
She was like 20.
She was 22 when she died.
Well, when she had the baby, she was 19.
Okay, yeah, so would have, yeah. Yes. Yep, she gets married and married to him in 76. They moved to Germany. They moved, okay, so I want to say that Sativa was born in 77. Her daughter, so she would have been, 19.
19. And how old was he?
Richard, I don't have his exact date of birth memorized. He's a couple years older, but, he's also, early 20s.
Yeah. It's impressive that they would have the self-awareness to say the child's not, in the best hands with us.
That seems, at that age. Right, pretty mature, both of them. He had been to Saratoga a couple months before she's killed, actually maybe like a month and a half. And they had, apparently he was coming to Saratoga to talk about, what's our plan going forward. Are we going to split totally? Are we going to try to get back together? Are we going to, see if we can make this work? And it sounds like at that time that they both come to an understanding that, no, this is not going to work. It's not what we want going forward. And like I said, apparently there's no issue over custody or, who's going to have the child. Because even after she's killed, Sativa ends up living with his parents going forward. So he never actually retained custody or got full custody at any point, even after the baby's mother is killed.
So they were trying to work it out from like May. She moved back permanently, 1980.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, May of 80, January of 1980. It sounds like she comes back to Saratoga for a visit from when she's out in Colorado. And then goes back out west, and then in May moves home for good. Gets enrolled in this secretarial school down the street, and is putting all her friends that we talked to, and everyone at the time. That was her motivation, was to get get herself back on her feet, get a career, so then she can be a mother and, you know, take Sativa full time. And that was what, like I said, with all her friends, that was her motivation to be going to this school.
Where was Richard living at the time of Sheila's death?
Long Island.
Okay. He's out in quite a ways away.
Yeah, he's out in Greenport, Long Island, which is almost all the way, you know, out to the end of the island. So he's out there.
That's a few hour trek just to get here, right? At least. Might even have to take a ferry.
Four hours driving, I would say, at least. I mean, easy if you're going with no traffic.
Okay.
Was she dating at the time?
Not exclusively. I mean, she had different boyfriends listed in the case file, different people that she had seen, you know, socially. She's 22, so, you know, still young, still going out, you know, a lot and socializing. So nobody that we, you know, see or that comes out from the original case files that was like a steady, you know, low exclusive boyfriend.
And why did you two get involved in this? And who are the original detectives?
The original detectives, there was Tom Mitchell. Dan Jewett was another investigator that handled it. I don't know if anyone else after that took over after the two of them pretty much did the majority of the...
They were the primaries. Tom Mitchell was an investigator at the time that, like I said, did a lot of the original investigation, a lot of the original interviews with Dan Jewett. Ken King was the detective lieutenant at the time, ran the division. He's done some of the follow-up stuff with Tom as well.
What happened with the case files? They started the case. They worked on it for how long? And then where did it go?
Until, I mean, they. I know talking with Tom, he's like, you know, I worked the case until I retired. You know, up until, you know, there's still. You could see, you get a progression going through of like, all right, 1980, ton of tips, ton of you know follow ups. And then you get into 81, and it kind of, okay, less, but still, there's still some good leads and things coming in. 82, a little bit less, and then, you know, from there, it just gets fewer and further between that a tip comes in or a call, and then it's always been an open investigation with our department. There's been a couple of tips throughout the years. I think, like, 2005, there's a call that just came in out of nowhere. We have a 24-hour tip hotline. With our department, that somebody called in, you know, something with this case, you know, go talk to this person. And then I think that had been it from 2005 up until, you know, Matt and I had kind of took our turn looking into it. And we did a couple of stories of local media, local newspaper, and generated not nearly as many tips as we'd have liked. I think we got like six new calls that, you know, we followed up with, and we've got a list of our own just going through people we want to talk to again or...
Just to re-interview them just to see if we can... And they could paint a better picture than reading the stuff. You know?
It's interesting coming from this point of view in 2019 and thinking back to 1980, which doesn't really sound like it was that long ago, but it was 40 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Almost 40 years ago. And everything that's changed, like with technology, I can imagine how frustrating it must be to look through these. Is it frustrating to look through these and seeing, like, how slow communication was back then compared to now?
We've definitely got it easier. You know, we've got it much easier than these guys. You know, I've said a bunch of times, like, I don't even know how do you come by some of these tips or some of these avenues to follow up of, you know, there was a rape in Ithaca, New York, or...
Yeah.
You know, somebody that got killed in Buffalo, like, you may want to look at this guy because he could be connected, how that information even makes its way to Saratoga Springs.
Right, and then, so you call up from Ithaca, you call up Saratoga Springs because you somehow think that they would be interested in it.
Or even knew that this murder occurred.
And then you have to rely on the other department making that connection on their own.
Sure. Someone's got to make that connection.
Mm-hmm. Call up. That person on the receiving end has to be receptive to that, and then they have to somehow get the information back and forth. So do they take a trip down there? Do they, like, mail it?
There's a lot of, like, teletype stuff, you know, going through. There's faxes. There's just handwritten, you know, so-and-so detective wasn't working today, but I took a call for you from this guy, and just a, you know, synopsis kind of note type thing. And there was, you know, I'm sure they didn't have voicemail, individual voicemails like we do now. Right. Where
no cell phones.
Yeah. I mean, I pictured them like smoking a cigarette and the ashes are like hitting the...
Probably, yeah. You know, the like shoulder holsters.
Shoulder holsters. Yeah. Yeah. So
this is a pretty big case file, it seems like. A few binders here.
We're not experts in case files.
Yeah, is this one of the bigger case files you guys have come across at the station?
I mean, for this, it's you know, we have case files that we've kept, you know, for certain cases. This one's probably one of the bigger ones, just because of the paperwork it generated. When you go through it, even the memos he's talking about, when somebody took a phone call, you know, there's memos in there from 1986, took a phone call from such and such, you know, and they would jot down, and it went in the case file. So that helped. That's helpful. It wasn't discarded. And it may not have been important then, or no one thought it was significant, but it's one of those things we want to look at just in case, you know, it was missed or overlooked.
Did anywhere in the case file, any tips come in where someone said, this person confessed to me in this murder, or anything like that?
There's actually quite a few of those.
Really?
Yeah. Really?
There's a lot of, a lot of, they're all followed up, they're all interviewed. There was, I remember one just, what was the one I was reading last night? The mother called in a son because he was lazy and she wanted him to get a job, so she thought that by a sheriff's deputy coming to talk to him, that would motivate him to get out and find a job. There's all sorts. Like I said, this was a huge, you know, story in Saratoga Springs at the time, you know, and still is, you know, 40 years later, a pretty big story because we don't get these unsolved murder type things. So crazy people calling in just to get attention, people calling in on their acquaintance because they are crazy, and that's enough of a reason to think they're the killer is, okay, this guy's crazy. You want to look into him, or, you know, this guy once said to me, you know, we were dating, I'm going to kill you. So I think it was him. And, you know, we had one of those not too long ago.
No, it was one of those things where he you know, somebody showed a particular interest in a cold case. I can't remember if it was this one or not, but the girlfriend kind of took notice of it. And he was always kind of weird to me and stuff. So obviously maybe that's... he had something to do with this,
yeah.
You know, but it's just like it's like your urban legend. Everyone talks about this case for years on. So,
was there a toxicology report done?
Yes, there was, as part of her autopsy.
Okay, and she was she did have some alcohol in her system.
Yep, she did have some alcohol in her system. She was at a 0.25 or 0.025 BAC at the time, which is blood alcohol content.
So that's intoxicated.
At the time of autopsy, and she's, you know...
This is at the time of the autopsy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And was that changed from the time she dies?
I know it is. I'm not an expert as far as how it breaks down. I know it's a different rate you know, where if you're staying awake, you know, you're going to go down at a, you know, more of a scientific measure of how much your BAC is going to go down. I couldn't tell you once you're deceased at what rate. I'm assuming it's much slower. Mm-hmm. You know, the alcohol is breaking down in your system.
So was there a lot of empty alcohol containers in her apartment or something? Is that kind of a clue to say that she got intoxicated somewhere else that night?
A little bit of both.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't a whole... They didn't say there was a significant amount of alcohol bottles or beer cans or any of that kind of stuff that seemed to jump out at him. I know there was a bottle of...
It's a bottle of vodka.
Vodka.
There's bottles in the apartment, but, you know, everyone that was talked to at the time, it's like I said, the timeline is the kind of sketchy part of when she's out and where she's out at, but everyone seems to be in agreement that she was out that night at, you know, one of the bars, you know, downtown in Saratoga Springs.
Okay. And... So she was asphyxiated, that's the cause of death?
Yes.
And she was tied up afterwards and stabbed afterwards. How rare is that?
Extremely.
Yeah, for in Saratoga, very extreme. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've never heard of a case this.
So there's no other like case this. That has like a similar MO to it. Any
in
other?
Our city? Yes. No. Yeah. I mean, no.
Right.
You know.
There were calls that came in. That's I think how they got some of these tips was that I know there was one from Albany where it was a medical examiner or coroner that had seen something where somebody was stabbed post-mortem and it jumped out to them because even in Albany where they have, you know, much larger number of murders in per year than we do in Saratoga, that it stood out to them like, oh, Saratoga had something. And he mentions somewhere in whatever that tip from the medical examiner, he says, I've never seen another one, you know, in my career. So it's, I mean, even just hearing stories, you know, nationwide, I don't know if too many of someone is after death, you know, stabbed.
Yeah, so the person, the killer, took Sheila's shoelaces out of her own shoes, grabbed a couple of little, it looks like a bathrobe tie is what you said, and tied her up. Doesn't seem like a struggling Sheila probably couldn't have gotten out of that. It almost feels like ritualistic in a weird way. Like all that happened afterwards. What is there a working motive or theory that you guys have on that? Why that would have happened?
And there's a couple theories that maybe it was to throw us off or throw the police off, you know.
Just to like confuse the scene.
Confuse the scene. That was a thought.
Thought it could have been a, you know, just a consensual sex gone bad, you know, that she's possibly accidentally smothered, but then, you know, again, like Matt said, to make us think that it's, you know, something ritualistic or somebody that's mad at her, has some sort of rage, you know, like, okay, I'm going to stab her because that's what you do when you're mad at someone, but if it's like a rage killing, you don't see one stab wound.
It would, yeah.
More than one
certainly
stab,
not
yeah.
after they're dead.
Yeah. And there's been no other victims, right? So if it was some sort of ritual, there's been no other rumors of
not in Saratoga or any of our surrounding, you know, areas that we know of anything like, you know, like this, certainly. So we don't know, obviously. We don't know, but just... you know, talking to different people, even I think text was the time you get, you know, a handful of different answers, talking to a handful of different people. It could have been someone passing through that she, you know, had the misfortune of meeting that night, and this was their thing. But we, you know, never jumped out at us because the person then moved on to, you know, Oklahoma City or, you know, any other city in America.
Now, was there a sign of rape or?
No.
Nope. Okay.
So even if this killer was out with Sheila that night and drunk, perhaps, this person was comfortable being with her body after he or she killed her.
Sure.
For how long, do you know, or do you think?
Some amount of time, enough time that they're putting the shoes back, you know, after they take the shoelaces out, they're closing the window when they're going out, they're... tying her up, they're like
stabbing
I said,
her.
The stab wound isn't. Well, blood is still pumping. There's no spurting blood. There's no, you know, blood stains anywhere. It's, you know, enough that the blood in her body has stopped pumping altogether. So when the knife pierces her dead body, there's a single drop of, you know, the entry of the knife. So it's, you know, it's a decent amount of time, like you said, where they're comfortable. They're, you know, methodical.
And they weren't expecting anybody to come to her apartment in any period of time. So obviously they weren't expecting anybody to show up there. So either it was in the middle of the night.
Okay, that's interesting. You know. What does that mean? That means that there wasn't any screaming.
Yeah, I mean
because if there was screaming, I would imagine that they would be fearful that someone would call somebody.
There's reports when the students come to go see where she is, they can hear music. From inside the apartment.
Inside her apartment?
Inside her apartment, radio playing. And then witnesses from the surrounding apartments state they hear music playing. The uncle, when he goes to knock on the door, when he tries the door first, he can hear the music inside. So there's music drowning out. It was obviously loud enough that they can hear it outside the apartment. So does that drown anything? I don't know.
There was music playing from the time of her death, which was Saturday into Sunday, maybe?
Yes.
To Tuesday.
Till Tuesday, like a radio playing in the background.
Loud enough where people could hear it outside.
They could hear it at least in the hallway and outside the apartment. I don't know if they could hear it from the street or anything.
Okay.
But I, you know.
And the neighbors heard it, though.
Downstairs neighbor thinks that she hears some like sort of like party get together, but I think she describes it as like not a house party, but like a 3 or 4 person maybe
hanging out
gathering,
drinking.
You know. Yeah. So subdued, but that definitely sounds like there's more than just Sheila in the apartment.
So you're thinking that because the door, there was no forced entry.
No.
And the deadbolt, the top one, was locked from the inside.
It's not 100% on that. That is what the Sheila's uncle, who discovers the body, he goes out through this door.
He
leaves that way and goes. So he was asked at the time, and we asked him again. Obviously, he's going to be much less clear in the memory of it. But we're like, did you have to unlock that deadbolt? Are you sure? He's like, yes. I want to say that I did, but he's like, I'm also just discovered my dead niece in murdered in an apartment. Yeah. So I'm fumbling to get out of this apartment. So he's like, I'm not obviously the most clear that I've ever been. And
right. But when people came back into the apartment, it was open.
It was open. They noted in the case report that it was locked. So he does say something to the effect of the police officers, yeah, I did unlock it or I had to unlock it. But he does go out because the mom and the aunt are actually in the front door downstairs, and he goes out this door to tell them not to come up.
Oh.
And then talks to, I'm not sure, is it a downstairs neighbor or one of the neighbors. One of the neighbors in the apartment actually calls the police for them because they start screaming, call the police, and the neighbor comes out, obviously.
So when he goes up to knock on the door and he hears music,
he tries the door. It's locked, so they tell him, yeah, try the fire escape. She usually keeps that window unlocked.
Okay.
So that's when he goes up to the fire escape.
And he comes in. Opens it up. So the thinking is that the person who killed her leaves through the fire escape and shuts the window.
That's the thinking now. At the time, a set of her keys were missing.
Oh.
And that was, so that was a big, I'd say a big, like, hunt or something that was, you know, being pursued was, we find these keys, you know, we find her killer. Because somebody took the keys out of the apartment, but then they're later turned into the police where some kids across the street find them, like, at the bus stop. And it's, like, I want to say it's, like, when the snow is, like, melting. So, like, you know, spring.
They find keys, and then they turn them into the police.
Yes.
Did they know, did they have any thought that it might be her keys?
I think it was the father that knew that, you know, they're right across the street from the apartment. So, obviously, everyone in that neighborhood knows, you know, that this woman's been killed in there.
So now it could be the person took her keys and locked the door.
Locked the door on the way out.
Yeah. Oh, wow. And I guess, like, does that matter?
It certainly doesn't clear it up any for us, you know, because if anything, that just opens it up to, you know, that many more, you know, suspects.
Feels a little more personal even through the door than the fire escape.
But less suspicious to neighbors if anyone sees somebody walking out the door as opposed to walking out of a fire escape.
Climbing out the window. Yeah.
Were there any eyewitnesses?
No.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.